Tinder presents How to Become a Runner. Wake up at 5 a.m. Go for a run. Get blisters. Make running your personality. Miss work drinks for your long run. Meet a new friend. Shin splints. Join a run club. Go once. Or you can train alone. Or find someone on Tinder who actually enjoys early morning runs too, just like Charles and Melanie did. Wherever it takes you, it starts with a swipe. Tinder.
Hey, it's Dan Bova from Entrepreneur Media, and welcome to How Success Happens, the show where I talk to awesome people who do awesome things and ask the simple question, how on earth did you do that? Ready to get informed and inspired? I am too, so let's get to it. How Success Happens starts now. Today's guest is simply the enemy of trees. His books have sold millions and millions of copies, and he shows no signs of slowing. Please welcome the author of the very funny children's book series, Timmy Failure, and also the very funny comic strip, Pearls Before Swine, Stefan Pastis. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
So great to talk to you. Mild panic saying your last name. I'm like, is it Pastis?
You got it perfect. I wouldn't have said anything if you got it wrong.
Well, man, so great to talk to you. And as I said there, so 7 Timmy Failure books at this count?
There's 8, technically. We did a prequel for Disney when we did the movie.
And about 37,000 Pearls Before Swine collections?
You know, it's funny. I'm doing an event for the San Francisco Giants next week, and they needed a bio, and I had to count my books. There's 41 Pearls books, which astounded me.
And considering you did all of this in the past year, that is incredible. Quite an output. Well, obviously, you have done quite well, but let's talk about this word success. It changes for us over time, but I'm wondering, what does it mean to you right now, the word success? And maybe what did it mean to you when you were just starting out?
Well, starting out, it was clear. I was a lawyer for 10 years. And I didn't want to be a lawyer. So success would be making a living doing cartooning and being able to quit the law. In that, I succeeded. And then once you get into the profession, you know, you can get knocked out of my profession very easily because you only get a comic strip in newspapers when something comes out of newspapers. So when a new comic comes, they too can knock you out. So you're really on pins and needles those first few years. So then it was just staying in, and I managed to do it. I've been doing it for, gosh, almost 25 years. So that still is my measure for success, like being able to make a living doing it. I really look at sales. Like, for example, when I do a new book deal with a company, I do not check sales. I check if they reach out and say they'd like another one. If they like another one, I know I sold enough. But now I've sort of changed my definition of success. I stole it from Rick Rubin. He did the best book I've ever read on creativity. I finally felt like all the things I wanted to say to people about how odd this profession is about creating for a living, someone said the things I was thinking. And one of the things he said in there is he gives this definition of creative success, which is when the work you can hear in your head, you've executed to the best of your ability and you're satisfied with it. When you reach that point, that's it. Everything that happens after that, commercially, critically, whatever, you can't control that. So he shifts that point of success. And I love that. That has sort of been my thing ever since I read that.
That is a book on my list for sure. I've heard many people talk about how great it is. Do you ever, when you were starting out, because sometimes I feel like this too, when you read something like that, it's so inspiring. It's almost overwhelming. You're like, oh my God, I should be doing this. Why am I reading a book? I should be doing this instead. And your brain goes in like 10 directions. How do you keep yourself focused as a creative person?
I watch the input as much as the output. I think a lot of creative people just focus on the output, but you're only as good as what goes into you. No different than a weightlifter having to watch what he eats. So I'm always reading something. Like right before we talked, I'm reading this collection of Flannery O'Connor short stories. I'm always traveling. I was just in Oman, Saudi Arabia, and a lot of other countries. That's a huge input. Listen to music as I write. I try to listen to a bunch of new stuff. And then I have these conversations with people, particularly when I travel, where I just learn as much as I can. And all that goes into your head and sort of mixes around like one big stew. And then it comes out in weird ways. But if you're not watching that input, the output will either go dry or repetitive, which I'm guilty of myself at times, and I don't want to be. So I'm always taking in. Like if I find out you build roofs for a living, right? I'll ask you a million questions about heights and when you started, and I'm going to find out everything I can. I'm endlessly curious, and that feeds the process.
I think you would be better at my job than I am, but
really good.
So let's take a step back to the law. You know, I know reading about your, you know, obviously very talented artist, you were doodling as a kid a lot. Was there ever a time where you wanted to jump right into it, or what brought you to the law first?
Just being practical. You know, when I was a kid, I read the Peanuts comic strip like almost everybody in my profession, and it made me want to be a cartoonist. That's one particular book, the 25th anniversary of Peanuts, and Charles Schulz laid out his day where he got to the studio and he just thought of funny ideas. And I thought, man, I want to do that for a living. But what you encounter is the odds of success are pretty low. There's something like 1 in 30,000 because you have to get syndicated. As an individual cartoonist, you might think you can submit your work to newspapers. They won't even open it. You have to go through a syndicate. That's like an agent. There's only two of them left in the United States, and they each now launch maybe one strip a year. So the odds are low, but you know, I had to get out of the law. I disliked it so much. I was just determined. So when I kept getting rejected as a lawyer, when I would submit to stuff, I would draw on weekends. I just kept going because there really wasn't an alternative, you know, like I had to get out.
Well, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that, because no matter what you're doing, whether it's a creative endeavor or what, rejection is just part of the deal. And as much as people talk about loving failure, not your book, well, they love your book, but also the process of failing, you know, learning, it sucks when it's happening. It can be very defeating. So how did you deal with that in those early days? And how do you deal with it even today if maybe something you do, you get a comment that someone didn't like something?
I'm confident in what I can hear. Like creativity is, you're just an antenna. That's another point made in that Rick Rubin book. And I'm confident in what I can hear. I don't always execute it as well as I can, but I'm confident in it. So when I get rejected, I don't take it as a rejection of me. The hurt of it is the lost time. I hate losing time. And I do something especially bullheaded that almost no writer does. What you're supposed to do with the new book is you write a quarter of it and you send that to your agent. And then they buy or they don't buy it, and then you finish it. For the most part, I write the whole book. The reason why I do that is I really don't want a co-pilot. Like if you give it to the agent and the publisher and it's a quarter of the way done, they're going to have their say on that other three quarters. Well, I like to build the whole car and say, here it is. Do you want the car or do you not want the car? But you know what the car is. So the advantage of that is it's truly your own vision. The disadvantage is you've lost 4 months. Like my wife, Stacy, would say it's not lost because you wrote every day and you got better as a writer. But it sure feels like lost time. I really don't take it personally. I've never sat back and thought, oh, I must be bad or I must. It almost doesn't occur to me. I'm stupidly confident in what I can hear. And I know when I can't hear. There are days where, like if I go home and I haven't written well, I don't say I didn't write anything. I say I couldn't hear anything.
Ah, interesting. Man, I could just imagine you writing like the first half of Timmy Failure and the feedback being, we love it, it's great, but what if he succeeds?
You get so many ideas. And I'm not swayed by criticism. For one thing, I don't read the stuff. When the movie came out, they were sending me reviews and I was like, no, I really don't look at them. If you send it to me, it will be hard to look away, but I don't read any of that. Scott Adams, who is really why I have a career. The creator of Dilbert told everyone to read my strip in its early days. That was really my big break. He told me something once that has always stuck in my head because it is held to be true. He goes, of your audience, 20% will love you no matter what, even when you don't deserve to be loved. 20% will absolutely abhor your work, no matter how good it is. All you're really doing is fighting for the middle 60. So there's no reason to look at the reviews or the comments or any of that because it's going to fall into those baskets. And that's really held true.
That's a great way to look at it. I want to talk about you making the jump from comic strips to the books, but I was curious about, you know, I'm sure you get asked for advice all the time and you mentioned, you know, syndication, but it is a very different world out there. You mentioned this word newspapers. So what is your big advice for people who are just comics strip artists who are just getting started now?
Yeah, unfortunately, that has changed. I cannot tell them to take my route because it's really not open anymore. So that's the bad news. The good news is there are a lot of guys who have succeeded tremendously with strips that are really well known. And they have done it on their own through social media. They have built this audience. They have to do some stuff I don't have to do because I get an income from newspapers. They have to then sell merchandise and stuff, which seems like a lot of work to me, but they have succeeded in it. They attend all the conventions, and that is the route. There is still a need for what I do. You know, there is still a need for a short laugh with recognizable characters that you see every day, quick in, quick out. That has not gone away. So yeah, that's the good news. It's a different route. It's still hard, but it's a different route.
And that process of those, you know, couple of boxes, I know your lengths vary on the Sunday and the daily ones, but how do you map that out? Are you starting from box one with the thought and seeing where it takes you? Do you start with the punchline? What's your process like?
There's two steps to that. I go through the day, and when a phrase or something hits me, I open the voice memo app on the iPhone and I say the phrase into the phone. I know there's something there. I just don't know what it is yet. So that's the first step. Then the second step is I play really loud music and I either sit in a cafe or go for a walk and I don't force it. I just let that idea sort of bounce around in my head. I have all these analogies for what writing is like. It is the opposite of late night cramming for a test. When you were in college and you didn't do your studying for the whole year and you had to get it all in that last night, you would just grit your teeth and clench your fists and you pull an all-nighter, you get through it. And you can do that. There are some things in life that require creating is like trying to float in a pool or balance on a beam. You'll sink. It doesn't work. Or analogy is, to pet a cat. Say you're trying to pet a cat in a room and it's you and the cat. If you run at that cat and say, come here, cat, that is not going to work. So the muse is like that cat. You have to sit there still in a room and relax. And in her time, that cat will come to you.
But you have a daily deadline, right? So how long can you wait for the cat?
That's my advantage. I'm currently low. I'm 6 months ahead, but sometimes I'm as high as 9 months ahead. So if you have any ideas, I don't worry. The other thing I do is once you start having ideas, this I've noticed, I would love to talk to more creative people about this, but man, this is a truism if ever there was one. Where there is one idea, there are more. It's like pulling a train with your teeth. It starts to go down the track. It's just those first few steps. So once it starts moving, there's more there. If I'm guilty of anything, it's cutting it short, either by an artificial deadline, like it's noon, or I've already written five. Just play that out because you don't know when that's coming back. You could sit down tomorrow and have zero.
So what do you think about people who are, you know, I want to write, what's your advice, I should say? Not what do you think of them? I'm sure you think they're lovely people. But someone who's decided, I'm going to write something and I'm going to put myself on a schedule and I'm going to write 1,500 words a day and I'm going to be done in 2 months or whatever it is. What are your thoughts on that? Because that's a common thing.
Whatever works for you, works for you. There's a lot of ways to skin this cat.
petting the cat, you're skinning it.
The cat is coming up a lot here. You're cutting short the ability to be in the moment. You know, it's like someone, like you're going to have sex with somebody and you wrote down all the moves beforehand, like in the order and the time they would occur. Doesn't that strike you as absurd? I think writing is the same. I've noticed it with travel too. When I let the day ping around wherever it goes, just amazing things happen that sometimes seem preordained. You put yourself in that river, whatever it is, thought, energy, and it takes you places. I call it top-down writing. I try not to write top-down, which means your brain thinks, oh, this strip will be about a dad who's a garbage man and the mom is in the PTA and they have three little kids and they have a dog and they live on the corner. Okay, go. Wow, I just took the whole world of ideas and went, let your brain do it. Let it generically rise up. And everyone knows how to do it. I give this example to people all the time. When you're at a party and your friend says something to make fun of another friend and the second guy joins in and you go to join in, what you never do is go, okay, I'm about to make a comment that this half of the room should find ironic.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. You know, writing should be no different. So,
did you have this kind of free flowing, you know, process when you were a lawyer?
No, that's so different. That's so left brain. That's all logic. It's the opposite. I'm a weird right brain, left brain mix. It's actually the reason why I play that music. I know Stephen King writes to music. I haven't heard of many other people that do it. The first question I get is, does the music have words? And yes, it always has words. But they say, isn't it distracting? And I go, it's super distracting. And that's the point. What I'm trying to do is knock the left brain out and let the right brain dominate. Because the left brain will always try to get a hold of it and figure out funny. I try to not be involved in the process. Now, when I have to edit the Timmy book or edit anything, I notice without thinking the headphones come off because I can't focus. But the rest of it, I'm barely there.
Can you give us the greatest hits of your writing playlist or is it always vary?
It's all pretty moody, like Radiohead, Arcade Fire, U2, Neil Young, Dylan. Yeah, it tends to be, it's rarely bouncy, upbeat.
That's so interesting. So for anyone who hasn't experienced Timmy Failure yet, you would find a great chasm between the type of music you just talked about and what Timmy and his adventures are like, which are just, you know, off the wall, hilarious, which isn't exactly how I describe Bob Dylan, but
I've heard that before too. Like comedians are people, they're alchemists, that they take sadness and turn it into joy. You know what? There's a great clip of Dick Van Dyke eulogizing Stan Laurel. And he has this great quote about alchemy and comedians turning that. And I've always been sort of fascinated by that. Like, I think in person, we're a little more dour than you would expect us to be. So I think that's how we cope, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. So you mentioned Peanuts, and I wanted to ask you about your encounter with, you know, many people's childhood hero, Charles M. Schulz. Can you talk a little bit about that first encounter and what it meant to you?
Yeah, it was crazy. I was a lawyer. I was in the middle of a horrible case, and I hated it. And I read in a San Francisco weekly newspaper that every day Charles Schulz had an English muffin every day in Santa Rosa, California, at his ice arena that he built. There's a little cafe attached to the ice arena. So I asked my wife, Stacy, where this ice arena was. This is before the days of Google. Stacy grew up in Santa Rosa, and so she told me. We were living down in the Bay Area at the time. And so I took the day off of work. And on the hunch that the article was right, I went to the cafe at 7 a.m. and I waited and I waited and I waited and he didn't show up. And I was gathering all my stuff thinking, what a dumb idea. Like the article could have been wrong. He could be on vacation. And as I get up to leave, on the opposite door, on the opposite end of the cafe, in walks this guy with all this white hair. And I knew it was him. And I don't know who your like childhood hero is, but he was everything to me.
I'll just interrupt quickly. The first person I ever wrote a fan letter to and got a response, but keep going.
And so I was really nervous. And he got his English muffin and he read the San Francisco Chronicle. And I waited for him to be done with everything. And it looked totally odd because we were the only two people in the cafe. And I hadn't ordered any food. So I'm just staring at him. So when he's done eating, I cross the cafe and I literally kneel, appropriately enough, at the side of his chair. And in the worst opening line ever, I say, "Hi, Mr. Schultz. My name is Stefan Pastis and I'm an attorney." And Sparky's face, we call him Sparky, his face went red because he thought he was getting served with a subpoena. So I tried to calm him down. I said, no, but I draw. And then Schultz, he goes, "Do you have your stuff with you?" And I did. It was in the car. So I went to get it. By the way, that walk to the car, that's like being really good at wiffle ball with your cousin. And then Ted Williams shows up. "I hear you hit pretty well." All of a sudden, it gets very real. So Sparky looked at it and he was great. He gave me all these tips. He sat there for an hour with me and I took this picture with him and it's crazy.
I've been to that ice arena.
Oh, you have?
I have, because a million years ago, when I worked at Maxim magazine, I did a profile of an upcoming chef named Guy Fieri, who lived in Santa Rosa. I hung out and barely survived with him for a night and was the most hungover I have ever been in my life the next morning. I could barely see straight, but I knew that this ice arena and the museum was there. And I was like, I have to go. And so I did go to the ice arena and had the world's worst headache, but it was worth it.
That's funny. That's great. That's so cool. Yeah, Guy is from here as well. It's pretty cool.
Have you ever spent any time with Mr. Fieri?
Very briefly, and I'm sure he wouldn't remember it. Our kids were on the same soccer team, and I was invited by a radio DJ to a taping of Dives, Drive-Ins.
Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, yeah.
Yeah, I think the producer of the show was a fan of the strip, so I went and watched him film. But yeah, he's our native son.
Speaking of children, when you think about Pearls Before Swine or Timmy Failure, is there a favorite child? Do you love them equally? Is one, let's say, easier for you? How do you relate to both of those things? Because they're similar, they're both hilarious, but they're different.
Yeah, all the characters in Pearls are me to some extent, but Rat is definitely me. And then Timmy's me as well. So the difference is, when you do a comic strip, it is such a particular skill. I think that people would think that the challenge is writing the joke, and that's true, but the real challenge is the brevity. Like, I have to set that up in panel one, and I should probably be done with the joke by panel three, and then commenting on panel four. That's way harder than it seems. So when you open that up to me, and you give me 270 pages in a book, that's it's almost too big for me to see. Like, when I wrote the first Timmy book, the way I wrote it was, every day when I started writing, I literally went back to page one and read the entire book up to that point. So I can remember where everyone was at the time. I didn't know how else to do it. So my canvas has always been something I could see with a glance. My canvas is too big to see.
Holy cow.
The advantage of that brevity is, when Disney wanted to turn Timmy into a movie, the director and writer was this guy named Tom McCarthy, who did the movie Spotlight that won Best Picture. And he liked the Timmy Failure book. And I asked if I could write it with him. And so he tested me, had me write a scene, and he liked it. And sure enough, we ended up being partners for 2 years in writing this script. But one of the things I realized in doing it was, I had this natural advantage for a first timer, which is brevity. The people who struggle with scripts are the great writers like Faulkner and Fitzgerald. When they go to do a script, they have too much. And I've never had space. So wasn't that hard of a transition, interestingly.
It's the cinematic event of the year. Critics are saying a stunning, breathtaking triumph of savings. It's 2-for-1 cinema tickets from Compesa Market in cinemas all year.
That sounds like a great movie.
Sergey, it's no movie. It's 2-for-1 offer on cinema tickets.
Oh, yeah. I knew that.
Get 2-for-1 cinema tickets every Tuesday or Wednesday with Compesa Market. Simples.
When you take out a qualifying product to Compare the Market, one membership per year, participating cinemas, two standard tickets only, cheap as free. T's and C's apply.
No.
What about that transition of this is the thing that's coming out of your head and your hand is either drawing it or typing it, and that's what it is, to you have a collaborator who has an opinion and maybe wants to do a little something different with something that you created? What was that like?
That is the reason why most people might not know this. Whenever you write a book or a play or whatever, and they seek to turn it into a movie, the very first thing they do is they kick the original writer out of the room. What they want to do with you always is give you a line in the contract that says meaningful consent or something like that. Like, in other words, you can comment on what they're doing. And they do that for a good reason, which is that these writers are so precious about their work. So Tom wanted to meet with me and see how precious I would be. So he started testing me with Timmy's, the mom's boyfriend. He said, you know, this character won't work for these reasons. And I said, oh, cool. Let's change it. Yeah. And he's like, ah, okay. So you're not going to be that guy. And once he had that assurance, it worked. But they do that for that reason. So he said to me over and over, this is not a book, it's a movie.
Was that hard, though?
I mean, I'm literally talking to the guy who's holding the Oscar for Best Picture, and my experience was reading a book on screenplays. So okay. When I know I'm with somebody great, I'm an observer. If anything, I'm a nuisance in the sense that I'll ask a billion questions. And it wasn't just Tom. I was doing everything because I was on the set every day, and I knew nothing about filmmaking. So that was quite an education.
So is that something you want to pursue? Would you think about directing your own thing?
Yeah. So I'm working right now with two writers on doing a Pearls movie, which would be animated. So I think they wanted to initially do it without me, as I was saying, but I've wormed my way into it. So yeah, I do. It's really fun. I mean, that was such a high. Imagine you're this idiot, i.e. me, who sits at your laptop and you type out this first page, where Timmy is in a Cadillac and he drives it into a house. And you just wrote it because it struck you as funny. And then one day you're in Vancouver, Canada, and there's 200 people setting up a ramp with a stunt driver, and they've built an entire house for the sole purpose of driving a car into it. And the only reason any of that is happening is because that idea popped into my head. That's not a high. You're dead. Come on.
Wow, that is incredible. Well, definitely a high, and definitely like a, oh my God, I hope this makes sense, or like.
Yeah, totally. The fresh high.
So before we get into the yet to be trademarked speed round of this conversation, I do want to ask, fans of you know where to find you, but people who are discovering you for the first time, like, what's the best place for them to get all things Stefan Pastis?
Yeah, I think just pearlscomic.com. Is that where it is? I don't even know. Just go on all the socials. They're under my name. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. And then the comics are online. They're also in your newspaper. The books are in bookstores. Yeah, it's everywhere.
You talked about social media being like, you know, the platform for upcoming artists today. How involved are you in it, in your own social media? Are you glad not to have to do it, or you love doing it? What's your take on it?
Yeah, you ask at an interesting time, because it's all me. And other than posting photos from Saudi Arabia, I have not posted anything in probably 2 or 3 months. And joy that has been. I'm so torn because I know the necessity of it. But also that whole thing I was telling you about listening and being the antenna and being open to the ideas, you ruin that when you have that level of contact. It just, everyone has all sorts of opinions, and it just, it is not good for the artistic process. And also what you do is you write and create stuff for the reward of those systems, which is clicks and likes. And is that good? Does that produce something that long-term is good? In other words, how many of the great works of art that you've seen, not that what I do is a great work of art, but how many would have been just battered if they had posted that and seen the first reaction? Who among the artists and writers and musicians that you know and love would have said, oh shit, this won't work. They hate it. You know what I mean? Imagine Velvet Underground testing their stuff out in 1967. What would have happened? People would be like, what? That woman can't sing. What are you doing? And that album is arguably the single most influential, you know, album that ever sold less than 100 copies. in the world. Every band cites it. So does the internet ruin that? I think it does.
Yeah, you think about Michelangelo, like, why does this guy don't have any pants on him? You know,
you'd be so knocked off your feet. Like, it can't be good.
One thing that I had read or heard from someone once was like, you know, if you're going for a walk, like maybe one time don't have your headphones on. Let your mind be bored for 2 seconds and you'll be surprised what pops into it, which I try to do. But then I get bored and, you know, being bored sucks. And you're waiting for your dog to take a dump. And it's like, come on, let's move on with life.
You know what? Let me say one other thing about that thing about posting stuff. I don't know about you. I have this working theory about music. The great albums that have stuck with me for my life, on the first listen, I didn't love them. But the thing they all have in common is I played them again. And conversely, there are very few albums that I absolutely fell in love with on the first listen that I still listen to.
You've got to give us one.
Well, I can't think of the latter, but like, for example, on the former, like Astral Weeks by Van Morrison, that's challenging. And Blood on the Tracks by Dylan. It's not immediately like a Dylan album, and then I can't stop playing it. So my point is, if you are aiming for immediate feedback that's positive, are you creating a Blood on the Tracks, or are you creating just the Osmonds? Like, something reach the top of the charts, you know, it's easy. Well, that's Danny Osmonds who may be listening.
Yeah, well, he is my cousin, but whatever.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know the answer to that, but I wrestle with it.
The thing I always think about too is with like Spotify or whatever, you know, you're listening to your version of greatest hits or whatever, but you think about those tapes that we listen to or albums, and there was that one song they didn't really like, but you kind of were forced to listen to it, and now you love it, even though like you would have skipped it and never listened to it again.
Yeah, I mean, Radiohead is always challenging their audience. They just shift up stuff crazy. And your first reaction to any new album is always like, oh. And then fast forward 3 months, you're like, oh.
Yeah, right. Well, I look forward to seeing where this conversation brings Pearls Before Swine, how you're going to switch it up in, I guess, 9 months from now. That's going to blow everybody's mind.
Do you want to be in it? I'll put you in it. I'll make you a character. It's never flattering. I'll warn you in advance.
Oh, my God. If you did that, I would just retire. I'd be done. All right, speed round. First question was submitted by my friend Cindy, who is an aspiring children's author. She asks the deep question, what's it like being so awesome?
Well, thank you. That's such a trap. But if you say great, you're a total douchebag. So I will just say I would know. I will say one thing. There is one advantage to what I do, that I get an invite to go to the United Arab Emirates and speak to kids. Like, what a thrill that is. As somebody who came from a job that I know was hard work and I hated, I know how lucky I am that I get something like that. Or I read a great book and I mention the author in the strip and suddenly I have contact with the author. Like, what a perk that is. I put Ken Burns in the strip a few months ago and I'm going to go have lunch with him in August at his studio. And what a joy that is. So that's pretty awesome.
That is great. I was going to ask you, and not looking to paint you as a douche or anything like that, as you said, but is there something that, like, when things started clicking and things were going well, did you buy something as like a, this is for me, reward? I can't believe I got here.
I pay for travel. I'm on the road probably 3 to 4 months a year. I don't travel extravagantly, but that's been the biggest perk of money. I'm so addicted to it. I love travel. That's going to be my next series of books. I've already written one, but just these experiences on the road, that is high for me.
That's awesome. So is that like Mark Twain? Did you ever read his travel book?
All of them.
Innocence Abroad, is that it?
Yeah.
It's a great book.
You know what's funny about him? Not always, but generally speaking, those books are still funny. Humor does not play in future generations. That does.
100%. I read that book and I was laughing out loud and I was like, oh my God, damn you, Mark Twain.
There's one when he comes west to join his brother in Nevada and he has to take the stagecoach.
Roughing It?
Yeah. And he has to sit on the mail and then a woman comes onto the stagecoach and she won't stop talking. And his annoyance at her it could have been like The Office. Like it's as funny now as it was like in the 1870s. That's mind-boggling.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we've talked a lot about music and things like that, which is typically a way that people turn their brain off, but it sounds like it's the way you fire up your brain. So what is there, or is there a way that you, a favorite way for you to turn off your brain?
Music. I disappear into it. I don't know what time it is. I don't even know what's playing. I just started doing transcendental meditation. God, that's mind-boggling too. That works as well. Those both work. Yeah, that's helpful. That's weird. I wonder, is it turning off the brain or is it turning on the brain? Like, it's definitely tamping down the logical left brain side, which I've never found funny. I wish everyone could experience that state. It is so deep that I kid you not, when I'm coming out of a writing session, when I walk out the front door of the studio, I don't always do it, but I will often look down to make sure I have pants on. That's how lost in your own brain you are.
Okay, so who would win in a fight, Rat or Mickey Mouse?
Oh, Rat for sure. Rat would fight dirty. Yeah, Mickey would just squeak and Rat would just batter him with... I've never seen Mickey take a baseball bat to anybody, have you?
Okay, and finally, do you doodle when you're bored? And second part, did you doodle during this interview?
Oh, I should have. No, I was too engaged. I doodled all the years I was a lawyer. Yeah, I will doodle. You know when I doodle? I doodle when I sit there in a cafe and I can't think of anything. You just doodle. Have you ever looked at your doodles at like, you know when you're on like a 2-hour phone call with somebody and you just doodle? If you ever go back and look at them, they're not meaningless. If you really look at them, they will reflect aspects of the conversation. It's you know what that is? That's your subconscious. Is you couldn't focus. What you were focusing on was what the person was saying, but what your brain was doing, that's how I write. That's a great example of how I write.
I used to draw mushroom clouds a lot, so maybe that has something to do with my state of being when I'm in a meeting.
I draw those too. Those are pretty cool. I saw in another interview, don't you guys ask a bad habit or something?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, so we always ask, what's a habit you are grateful to have and what is a habit you wish you could kick?
Yes, I'm ready with the bad ones. In the morning, when I wake up, I go right to Boggle with friends. It's the old game Boggle, but it's an app. I have to win. So I lose, I would say, an hour and a half a day to Boggle with friends. The good habit that I have is I set a goal for the week and I always achieve that goal. So in a week where I'm here and not traveling and not doing a book, where I have to do the strip, I don't do 7 strips, even though that's what I'm obligated to do. I do 14. That buys me an additional week. But if you want to do 14 strips, you really can't screw around. That requires I do Sunday 3 on Tuesday, 3 on Wednesday. It's a thing. And my level of focus is very high when I'm focused. I will get done what I've set out to get done. And that's a level of discipline that's great, but it's slow to get started. In the morning, every writer I've talked to has had a version of this. We love what we do. Why do we put off doing it?
Right.
Every writer loses hours. It's not like we're tarring a roof in Phoenix.
Right.
This is easy work, right? I mean, it's not easy, but it's enjoyable work. It's fulfilling work. Why do we do that? It's so weird. I've never got a good answer to that.
I always think of it like it's like getting into a pool. It's just slightly cool. And you know, once you're in it, it's going to be great and you're going to have so much fun, but it's just getting into it. You're like, I don't know if that has any relation to it.
I think that's a good analogy. Yeah, that is what it's like.
Awesome. Hey, man. Well, this has been really great talking to you, hearing your story and just reading your stuff. It is very funny. So we appreciate all your hard work. And speaking on behalf of your neighbors, we appreciate when you leave the house wearing pants.
Thank you very much.
Help! I need your help! That's right, I want your help asking these guests better questions. Send them in to howsuccesshappens@entrepreneur.com. Upcoming guests, we got some big ones. Yes, you can ask directly. Mr. Guy Fieri, anything you want. send in a question to howsuccesshappens@entrepreneur.com and I will ask it. Also on the docket is Robert Irvine, host of Dinner Impossible and a bunch of other things you've seen on the Food Network and elsewhere. Ask these gentlemen anything you want, and if it's not too crazy, I'll ask it, even if it is too crazy.
You know what's funny? I've noticed this, just a side note. The number of people in my profession or stand-up comic who play music, especially drums, it comes up again and again, and it goes to my theory, and I think this has something to do with the music I play. Humor is rhythm. And when I say I hear things, I hear the rhythm. So my son has that same gift. So when he was little, I would show him the strips and have him rank that week's strips. And when he would get hung up on one, I wouldn't tell him what it was, but I would ask him, tell me what. And he goes, you have that word at the end. And I'm like, fuck. And I can hear it as sure as if you finish Beethoven's Fifth and then clanged your fist on.
Right.
It's like Carlin was all rhythm. You know, I'll tell you one thing that is the greatest thing to go to. It's the last thing I say. Once you get me talking about creativity, I go crazy. There is a comedy museum in Jamestown, New York, on the opposite side of the state of you. It's closer to Buffalo. They put it there, I think, because Lucille Ball was from there. It is the most hidden and incredible museum I've been to. It has Lucy's polka dot dress, the puffy shirt from Seinfeld, Charlie Chaplin's cane, the Smothers guitars. It's all there. But the thing that I honed in on was they have all of Carlin's stuff. And so they have his shows. When he did those hour sets, do you know that every word was written?
Really?
Every word.
Holy shit.
So when you hear him, even though he's conversational, he's reciting something. He was that particular that he didn't want any of the rhythm of that to be fucked up. So
yeah,
that is so worth your time.
That's awesome. Oh, I love that.
I should tell everybody about that thing. It's incredible.
Well, let me go first so then you don't get a big crowd there and I have to wait online.